to the podcast. We got fun and games. Well, actually, we got a lot of fun, but no games are planned today. We're going to be talking about some segments, going to movie reviews, going into some new theme songs and a lot of other things, too. It's the podcast. Welcome to the podcast. It's called Josh Figures It Out. Josh Figures It Out. Yeah. Yeah, I just did that. Yes, I did. As amazing as that rendition was, I do not want Guns N' Roses to sue me. So right off the bat, on this fourth episode of Josh Figures It Out, I think we need to figure out some sort of more long-term solution. Is that cool, guys? Can we launch right into this thing I want to do called theme song crowdsourcing? Because, as you know, one of the major themes of this podcast so far, I don't know if you've been picking up on themes. We're only four episodes in. But trust me, there are themes in this thing. There are layers. This goes much deeper than you realize. It goes all the way to the top. But one of the themes I've been layering in is that this show is as much your show, all you out there listening in radio land, podcast land, whatever. This is as much your show as it is mine. And it's really important to me that I keep soliciting feedback from you and trying to make the show you guys want to hear. We're working together. We're tandeming this. We're tag teaming this. So I'm going to be crowdsourcing the theme song. What does that mean? I will show you. I have whipped up in my laboratory that I installed in my house at great cost some beats, five different drum machine beats that could become the basis for a future theme song. Why I would record drum beats in a laboratory? Simple, it's got great acoustics. That's how I designed it. But listen, I whipped up five drum machine beats. You guys are going to pick the one you like the most. And then, once I have tallied up your votes, I'm going to put a bass line on it. Five different bass lines, actually. And then you're going to pick the bass line you like best, and then more instruments, and then a melody, and eventually, many, many episodes down the line, we will have a finished theme song. But it all starts with the rhythm. So right at the top, let's hear rhythm number one. So this, I was aiming for kind of a reggaeton thing. That's what the snares are doing there. I don't know if it's exactly reggaeton, but it's a nice complex beat that you could layer stuff on top of. Let's hear beat number two. Now this is slower. A lot more space in it. More down tempo. Some really nice drum sounds here. If we want to slow jam this theme song, this would be the one to go with. Let's hear beat number three. Now this is a party starting beat. When you hear this at the beginning of Josh Figures It Out, that means that rockin' good times are ahead. In a rolling on ecstasy in a packed dance club sort of way. Is that the vibe I want to establish here on this podcast? Maybe. Let's hear beat number four. This is an interesting one. Very glitchy. Barely a beat at all. But if you want to hear some nerdcore stylings for the Josh Figures It Out theme, this would be the beat to choose. Finally, let's hear beat number five. It's a good propulsive beat. Some nice fluttery hi-hats in there. I don't know, this is a promising one. It could be beat number five. So there you go. Beats one through five. Tell me your beat pick. And then next week, actually possibly not next week, next week I'm going to have some kind of special episode guest situation going on. Spoiler alert, but a coming episode soon. I will reveal the winner, and then I will reveal the five baselines for you guys to vote on. And then eventually, months down the line, we may finally have a theme song. And then you won't have to listen to me ruin Guns N' Roses songs anymore. I consider that a win, win, win. It's also a win for Guns N' Roses. But it's not a win for Velvet Revolver. because I'm assuming they want to see Guns N' Roses fall on their face. That's mean. No, I don't think so. I think Velvet Revolver, when they existed, of course, wanted Guns N' Roses to do well. I think they were hoping that they could both rise to the top of the charts together. To create a world where all the hit songs of the nation were Guns N' Roses and Velvet Revolver songs. It's sad Velvet Revolver doesn't exist anymore. It was nice that Scott Weiland was getting some work. Now I guess it's just Slash. What are the other Guns and or Roses doing? I do not know. Axl Rose presumably in a bunker somewhere, working on Chinese Democracy 2, which will come out in 75 years. And it'll be amazing. Let's back up, because I've gotten way off track already. I can't tell if I'm feeling loose or feeling over-caffeinated. I did have half of a Monster Rehab Pink Lemonade before coming in today. Maybe that's why I'm feeling so wiggy. But there is a method to my madness. Listen, folks, this is the fourth episode of Josh Figures It Out, the podcast where I figure out what my podcast is going to be. And while I think a lot of progress has been made towards answering that question, I don't even think we're close to getting a definitive answer yet. There's so much more left to explore. For instance, every one of these podcasts I've done so far, I've done 100% stone cold sober. Not only sober, but usually hopped up on some kind of energy drink. Part of the reason being I'm recording these late at night. It happens to be the only time I could get hours at the studio I am recording at the moment, because I cannot afford my own podcast equipment. So these are late night shows. It's a little weird for me, because typically I feel like I'm at my sharpest morning to midday. Maybe it's because I've gotten used to doing the Ella show in the afternoons. But even when we used to do those morning shows, those 5 a.m. morning shows, usually I felt pretty good at about 20 minutes into those shows. Late night is different. There's a certain, after the sun sets, my mind starts to shut down a little bit. So this has been a bit of an adjustment. With the help of energy drinks, I've gotten through it, though. Nonetheless, I also usually smoke weed in the evenings. But I haven't been smoking weed for these. I was worried that it would interrupt my flow or make me lose my focus. On the other hand, maybe it would make me more relaxed or more creative. Maybe I would find my flow a little faster with the help of some medicinal. So that's why today's show is going to be a bit of an experiment. I do have a lot of subject material to cover today. No real segments, no real structure. I've got a whole bunch of wildly disparate topics to talk about. All sorts of material I can throw at you guys. I don't even know if I'm going to get to it all. Some of it may have to wait for later episodes. But we're going to do this scientific method style. The first half of this episode is going to be the control group. See, I am establishing the hypothesis. The hypothesis is that I may do a more relaxed, better flowing show with the help of marijuana. Step two is establishing my control group. That means I'm doing the first half of this show, once again, stone cold sober. Then midway through this episode, I will take a break and I will step outside of the studio and smoke some medicinal marijuana, as is my right as a Californian citizen who is registered to do so for various disorders, including but not limited to anxiety, headaches, nausea, insomnia. You get the deal. Some of those things are actually true. Then I'll return and I'll do the second half of this podcast. We'll see if there's a difference. We'll see. Maybe it'll be a lot worse. Who knows? That's the beauty of science. Science! It's all in the name of science, people. But seriously, and if I can get serious for a moment, guys, I've actually been really happy with the first three episodes of this show. I feel like I sound better than I expected to sound. These shows are sounding a lot better flowing, more polished than I was expecting straight off the bat. And you guys seem to be responding great, too. I'm very happy with the amount of people who've listened so far and giving me their feedback. I've gotten some great feedback, and it's been mostly positive. That's all very exciting. But I also hear a lot of room for improvement, which is even more exciting. The idea that this podcast is already good, but I feel like it could be a lot better. That's amazing. I can't wait to hear what this will sound like in 3 months. I'm excited for my future self. But the only way I'm going to improve is by doing everything, trying everything, running experiments like this, seeing if it helps, if it doesn't help, and then I can use that knowledge to shape the direction of this podcast going forward, and that's how progress is made. Have you already forgotten that it's not about the destination, it's about the journey? You shouldn't have. I told you guys back in episode 2, you're on a journey with me. You're stuck. I am Moses leading you through the desert to Israel. It was supposed to take days, but it took 40 years. Think about that. Have you ever thought about that? Moses freed the slaves from Egypt, and then he led them through the Sinai Desert to Israel. You've looked at a map, right? You know how close Egypt and Israel are to each other. They're like right in the same area. Sure, it's not exactly like a trip you could walk in a day, but if you're motivated, as I assume you would be if you're a recently freed slave, going back to your ancestral homeland, it wouldn't take more than a couple weeks. It took 40 years. And that's because God misled Moses. He gave Moses bad instructions. He led them in circles. They just kind of wandered around for a while and kept running into other tribes who would attack them. God, of course, he fed them. He gave them manna from the sky to make sure that they, you know, didn't die or anything. But he didn't make it easy for them either. The Jews had to endure a lot of pointless, completely unnecessary suffering to get to their goal. So I guess to extend that analogy, if I am Moses and you are the chosen people, you're going to have to deal with some pointless, unnecessary suffering to get to the chosen land of a great, polished podcast week in, week out. In the meantime, sometimes I'll hit on gold. Sometimes I won't. Wow, I'm really mixing my metaphors. What is this? Is this the Bible or is this a gold hunt? A gold hunt? Wow. That's what it was, right? Over there, boys, I see some gold. Shoot it. I bagged that gold good. That gold dead. That gold got bullet holes in it. Probably decreases its value. I don't care. It's my gold now. Wait, what's that? You guys want me to answer some Twitter questions? Well, okay then. Twitter questions from you guys, where you ask me things on Twitter and I answer them. Remix. At ShufU10 asks, whatever happened to your movie Diamond Bar? For those of you guys who are not in the know, it was about 4 years ago, I guess. I think it was about 4 years ago now, that's right. Where I'd been writing scripts forever, but I decided I wanted to write a script that I could actually make into a movie. So I deliberately set about writing a script that I thought I could film for an extremely low budget. With the help of my roommate as DP, I recruited some actors, some aspiring actors from the local Hollywood scene who were willing to work for a cash stipend and some good clips for their reel. We filmed it all on $200 flip cameras. Then I spent a year editing it. And now it's 115 minutes long. It's a full-on feature-length movie. And I made it. I have it. I am the writer and director and editor of a feature-length movie called Diamond Bar, which I'm still pretty happy with. Looking back at it, I can see flaws. I'm still really happy with the script. I think the script is great. I love the performances. Man, Chelsea Switzer and Nick Cooper, my two leads, were so good. I was so lucky to find those guys because they completely were able to embody the characters, get in the spirit. They dealt with my craziness as a first-time director trying to get the entire thing captured on a budget flip cam and me convincing them, no, guys, it'll be fine. I made the entire thing for like $10,000. For $10,000, I think it looks pretty damn good. But if I were doing it all over again, I would probably try to hire a professional cinematographer who owned a real film camera. Well, a digital camera, like one of those red cams, something like that. Some of the scenes are too dark. I didn't know a lot about lighting. There are issues with it. I sent it out to a couple of film festivals. It didn't take off. I really just have it more as an example of what my writing looks like when you film it. And it, kind of like a calling card for me as a writer. And for that, I think it works great. but I don't plan to make any money off of it. So, considering that, maybe I should find a way to put it online and let you guys see it. I wouldn't want to charge anything for it. I would just love to be able to, like, have it on a streaming site somewhere. Is there a streaming site that lets you just put up, like, a two-hour video? I know YouTube doesn't do that. If you have any tips, at Radio TFB. If you really want to see Diamond Bar, let me know a good site I can host it on, and maybe I will do just that. I got a podcast recommendation from a couple of you Canucks on Twitter, at The Slower Coast and at Trucker Yakko. Both recommended I check out a show called Wiretap on CBC. I listened to a couple clips. I want to give it a full listen. It sounds very literary style. It reminds me a little bit of John Hodgman, who's one of my absolute idols. So I want to give an episode a full listen. Meet me back in an episode or two, guys, and I will come back with a review of that podcast. I'll let you know what I thought. At EDEBias27 asks, why do you say y'all? I thought that word was only for black people and southerners. Are you protective of y'all, EDEBias27? Are you a southerner yourself? I should reread that tweet. Why do you say y'all? I thought that word was only for black people and southerners. First of all, I have family in Texas, which means I can claim that word and use it as my own. Makes me kind of an unofficial southerner or unofficial Texan. I know Texas, you guys think you're like your own thing because you almost seceded that one time. Ooh, a big deal. I'm the Lone Star State. Everything's bigger in Texas. Just playing, Texas. I love you guys. But seriously, I think the word y'all is just kind of an elegant construction. Saying you all is very, very awkward. Saying you guys gets really repetitive. You know, this whole podcast is directed to a plural you. So if I have to keep saying, you guys, why don't you check this out? You know, I really like talking to you guys. You know, what do you guys think about this? And you guys, and it sounds so Valley Girl. I've used you folks a couple times. I like that. Maybe, like, use people. Like, hey, use people, move out of the way. I could just say you, but that's a little too unspecific. When I say you, it's more like, it's like, hey, you over there, you specific person. Y'all, it's one syllable. It sounds stylish. It works great. I think the Southerners and black people got this one right. Y'all is the way to go. At Buddy Shear says, the question I bequeath to you is this. Do you enjoy the punk rock? If yes, which bands? Please don't say the Smiths. Thanks. Buddy, thank you for bequeathing that question unto me. I accept your bequeathal graciously. First of all, the Smiths. Not punk rock. Doesn't mean I like them. But one thing you can definitely say is they're not a punk rock band. Really, they are, I think, one of the early standard bearers for what we would now call indie music. Something I once had a long conversation with Michael Tully about. The Smiths are his favorite band, as you might know. And he said once to me, the Smiths are awesome, the Cure suck. And I countered him, no, I believe the Cure is awesome and the Smiths suck. Take that and shove it. Look, that's really just a matter of taste. The Cure, they're associated mostly with goth music, mostly because of the way Robert Smith dresses, but they're really a pop band. They have made a number of amazing pop songs in a lot of different styles. Boys Don't Cry, Close to Me, Friday I'm in Love are all just pop standards at this point. The Smiths are a totally different thing. They are a lot moodier, they're a lot artier. Morrissey's voice is obviously very unique and lends everything they do a distinctive quality. Just kind of a different set of musical values that really set the pace for the beginnings of independent rock in the 80s, up until Pavement kind of changed the conversation by making it all about slacker roughness. My appreciation for the Smiths has actually grown quite a bit. I think Morrissey has some really interesting lyrics and kind of a great voice for what they do. They sound like nobody else. And I'll always give a band that's staked their claim on a truly unique sound their due. The Cure is still better. This is all kind of ignoring your main question, though, which is, do I enjoy the punk rock? And really, the answer is pretty much no. Unless you're putting some qualifiers onto punk, you know, thrash punk, art punk, post-punk, prog punk, steampunk. I like a lot of those. But straight-up punk, not so much. You've got to realize, punk is a reactionary movement, in essence. In the early to mid-70s, you had a lot of classic rock bands that were just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. This was the era of prog rock, you know, Pink Floyd, Emerson, Lake & Palmer, giant productions, 10-minute songs, album-length opuses, string quartets, multi-layered productions. Incredibly expensive recordings were made, to the point that it seemed like the ordinary guy didn't have a place in music anymore. And punk was a reaction to that, the idea that anybody can just pick up a guitar and start playing music, stripping away all the excess and all the pretentiousness and just making it about three chords and shouting and trying to find a catchy hook. It was obviously a seismic moment in the history of pop music. A lot of great bands came out of that. But you gotta understand that the music I love is way more influenced by those early guys. I love prog rock. I love Yes. I love Pink Floyd. I love a rock band that decides they need like an orchestra or string quartet or children's choir to really, really bring their songs home. I love over the top. I even kind of love pretentiousness. I love cheese. Punk was the opposite of all of that. And now, you know, going back and listening to a lot of those early first wave, second wave punk bands, you get the impression that there wasn't a lot there besides a look and an attitude and, yeah, some chords and some shouting. That's very reductive, I know, and there is, you know, I like the Buzzcocks. I like some of the more pop-influenced and later on some of the more metal-influenced punk music. You know, I could get really into grindcore, but straight-up punk doesn't really do it for me. At TMid07 asks this question. If you play D20 games, what class do you favor? You may have heard me talk about my love of Magic the Gathering in the past. I'm much more a Magic guy than I am a Dungeons & Dragons guy. Not that I wouldn't get into it. Not that I feel like I'm above that in any way, of course. More that I've just never really had the opportunity. None of my friends were ever D&D people. I'd kind of like to try a game sometime. It sounds like it's something that would be up my alley. I can tell you this, in all my time playing video role-playing games, you know, I do enjoy a Dragon Age or a Fallout. Fallout 3, one of my favorite video games of all time. Typically, my modus operandi is I build up my character's strength and constitution like crazy, and then just Hulk smash and melee attack everything I see. Probably a little bit of wish fulfillment in that. Maybe I wish I could barrel my way through a crowd of orcs in real life also. So if I were to play Dungeons & Dragons, my guess is I would be some sort of high-strength, high-constitution fighter. Maybe a mage? I don't know. And this leads neatly into my other regular segment. What's Josh been up to this week? What's Josh been up to this week? Hold on, I can do that one better. What's Josh been up to this week? I like that. Okay. And this week, the answer is lots of games, because the world has kind of been on vacation this week. You know I need to get back into the applying for jobs thing. But businesses just are not, like, hiring until, you know, until this coming Monday. As I'm recording this, it's still, you know, right in the wake of New Year's. So while the world has been on vacation, I've kind of been trying to enjoy it and be on vacation as well. Other than, of course, continuing to podcast and launching the 5-second rule, which if you haven't checked it out yet, you really should. The 5secondrule.bandcamp.com. 40 tracks, $7. Worth your while. But so there's been a lot of gameplay of various sorts. New Year's Eve, I had a very nice time with a few friends. We played a little bit of Apples to Apples, classic party game. And I really need to get Cards Against Humanity because that is amazing. But so we had the kind of non-naughty mainstream version. But Apples to Apples is still a fun game. particularly when you've been drinking champagne all night. And then most of the last week, I've been playing a game called Civilization 5. Civilization 5 is kind of evil. And it's made me wonder if video games in general are kind of insidiously evil themselves. And I'll explain why. But first, let me explain to you a little bit about what Civilization is. The gist of the game is this. You pick one of 40 or 50 famous world leaders from throughout world history. You know, Caesar, George Washington, Catherine the Great, Shaka Zulu, etc. And you start in the Stone Age, and you build a civilization from the ground up throughout the millennia until you get to modern times. And then they figure out which civilization is the most advanced and declare a winner. Playing this game generally takes hours. Depending on the length of game you choose, it could be anywhere from like 5 or 6 hours to 24 hours. It's a long-ass game. But there's something incredibly addicting about it. Like, let me explain to you the game I've been playing for the last week that's been dominating a lot of my life. I picked Augustus Caesar, a great leader of the Roman Empire. First thing I do when this game starts, they give you a city to start with. They give you one city, and eventually you build more cities after that. You get to rename your cities, and I always like to rename them after a theme. For whatever reason, this game, I was picking band names from the 90s as my theme. So my cities were Pavement, Sleater-Kinney, Fugazi, Beck, Blur. It adds an extra level to the game. It is hilarious to see a game tell you, "We've spotted a barbarian enemy near Moby! Somebody save Moby!" So anyway, you have one city to start, and then you are the leader of this civilization, so you tell this city what the workers inside the city should build. They could build a library so that you learn more science, which helps you discover new technologies, that helps you build cooler things. They could help you build a barracks, which helps you create warriors and archers to start building an army. So if you want to, you could attack other people's cities and just take them by force. You could build a museum, which gets you culture points, so that you could just say you're more artistic and cultured than everybody else. You start out totally isolated, but soon, you know, you're a few years in and you start discovering other players. Because you're exploring the territory, they're exploring the territory, so you meet other world leaders and you get to negotiate with them, you get to try to trade resources with them. If you want to, you can just insult them and try to provoke a war, or you could just declare war on them. Or get them to declare war on another player by making them your ally and then saying, "Hey, this guy's been picking on me," and then they start a war on him. Once you start playing long enough, you have a chance to unlock new government policies, and these policies affect, say, how quickly you can build buildings or how happy the people in your empire are. It's a turn-based game, which means that there's no, unlike StarCraft, there's no rush to try to create and manage your army. You can play at your own leisurely pace. Think about every move you make, every order you give people. And that's really all this game is just ordering your subjects around, telling people what to build, telling other leaders what to do, making sure you, and all the while, making sure you don't run low on gold, and you're keeping your citizens happy, and you're keeping the research going, so that you can unlock new technologies that bring you into the modern age. And by the end of the game, you know, you've started with, everybody starts with one city, but by the end of the game, of course, we're in the 20th century, the globe is filled, countries have planes, some countries have nuclear weapons, and you can win many different ways. You can, if you're a war country, you can win by exterminating everyone else. If you're a science country, you can win by building a rocket ship first. If you're like a diplomatic kind of guy, you can try to make friends with everybody and convince everybody to vote you world leader. And maybe that's part of why this game is so addicting, is that feeling of control over a whole country, over world history. And unlike, say, a SimCity, which can kind of get stagnant after a while, it feels like there's just constant growth. There's constant forward momentum. You're just hurtling forward in time. But really, I think what makes this game so powerfully addicting is that there's just a constant chain of accomplishments. there's always a chance to gain a perk, and there's like 50 different ways to gain perks. There's science perks, there's culture perks, there's gold perks, there's city perks. Every turn, there's you might get something new that makes your empire just a little bit stronger in a very specific way. And sometimes if you collect 5 of those perks, they can combine into mega perks, which all synergize with each other in different interesting ways. Not to mention that sometimes you try to accomplish a perk and you fail, which is almost more addictive. Like, every world leader in the game has the chance to build the Great Pyramids, but only one of them gets to, whoever gets there first. You could be working on building the Great Pyramids, but if somebody else builds them first, suddenly you failed that accomplishment, which paradoxically just makes you want to try harder for the next one. It's a very behaviorist thing, you know, like the psychologist B.F. Skinner said, unreliable rewards are more addicting than reliable ones. If you're at a slot machine and you pull the lever and you get all 7s and you win, and then you pull the lever again and you get all 7s and you win, and you pull the lever and you just keep getting all 7s every single time, eventually you just get bored. I mean, if it's spitting out money, of course you're going to take it, but you're not actually enjoying the game anymore. You're just kind of like grabbing money. It's the fact that you don't win every single time. It's the fact that you can almost win and get really close. And sometimes you get that reward, and sometimes you don't. Those unreliable rewards are what keep you coming back over and over and over again. And there are casino techniques in this game, too. You know, the idea that every time you get one of those little accomplishments, there's a visual cue, like your city gets all shiny for a second, or there's an audio cue, like a bum-ba-ba-bum! And these things, they get hardwired into your brain, because every time you get one of those cues, you feel good because you've accomplished something small, and so you just keep getting those cues over and over again. And this is what, in my opinion, makes video games so insidious. Maybe even worse than drugs and alcohol. What makes video games insidious is they make you feel like you're accomplishing something when you're not. A video game is a set of goals. They start out easy, and they get harder and harder, but they're designed very specifically, so you eventually get strong enough to reach those goals. You know, sure, the last level of the game is tougher than the first level of the game, but by the last level, you've got like a machine gun you didn't have before. So now you're just strong enough to reach that goal, because little by little, you've gotten stronger, you've gotten better. You're always getting a little bit better every time. Think about a game like Guitar Hero. You know, you've got this little plastic guitar controller, and at first even the easy levels are really difficult. But then little by little, you're getting better at hitting those buttons accurately. And soon you can do the medium songs, and soon you can do the expert songs. And you feel like you're getting better, and you feel like you're getting stronger. But you're getting really good at something that has no useful application whatsoever. You're really just getting really good at this time waster you bought. It's a facsimile of actually getting good at a real skill, like playing guitar. South Park, of course, parodied that perfectly. They did that episode about Guitar Hero where Stan and Kyle, trying to get 1 million points on Guitar Hero, find that they're actually learning what it's like to be a rock star. And they're getting better little by little until they finally reach 1 million points. What an accomplishment. And then the game says something like, congratulations, you're gay. Of course. But that's what's kind of scary about video games, is it leaves you, after a day of successfully playing video games, feeling satisfied and proud of yourself, like you've really done something, when all you've actually done is sit around doing nothing except playing this time waster you bought. That feeling of being good at something, that feeling of accomplishing something, is so satisfying. It's so addicting. At least to me, I think even more so than actual chemical highs. And it's a feeling that can keep you from actually accomplishing things. I know I'm susceptible to this. That's why I took this vacation, and I installed Civ on my computer because I got it for Hanukkah. And I started this marathon game because I'm getting it out of my system. I'm playing one really fun game of Civilization. It's almost over. I'm in like 1983 right now, and I'm kicking everyone's ass science-wise. That's usually my technique, as I build a shitload of libraries and observatories and just get smarter than everybody. And then at the very end, I bomb everybody to crap and build the rocket ship. But after that, I'm uninstalling it from my computer. Because I know it's going to suck up too much time, and I need it to do other important things. Like this podcast, which I'm about to go smoke weed on. In the name of science. Oh, the important things I'm doing with my life, Josh. And I guess that means it's time for an interlude. And I'm back. I was not supposed to do that here. Let's just keep it between us, y'all. See, I used y'all. I remember. I'm not that out of it. Just smoked a little weed. What's the big deal, right? What harm could it really do? It's medicine. It's why they call it medicine. Have you ever caused a scene at a fast food restaurant because something went wrong with the order? Either because it didn't come out right, or they, like, mischarged you or something like that. Have you ever really gotten pissed at one of the people behind the counter? There's a bowl place near my house. It's one of those places that just serves beef on rice, which I love. It's called Flame Broiler. I don't know if they have it outside of California. But I walk in there all the time. And the most recent time I walked in there, I saw two new things that had never been there before. First, I saw a huge sign that said, "Smile, you're on camera." And yes, a camera pointing right down at the customer. And then pasted signs around the store printed on like printer paper that said, "No refund. We will make you a new bowl or give you store credit, but no matter what, no refunds." So I immediately got to thinking something happened there. What happened at that restaurant? There must have been some incident that prompted both the camera and the signs. And it must have been a man or a woman. I don't know why I would be sexist there. A woman could easily have this sort of freak out that I'm imagining. But somebody who got their food bowl, this bowl of food which people only eat because they need things fast or they have food issues like me. This bowl of generic food got their bowl, something was wrong with it, and decided, "Nope, I don't want a brand new bowl. I don't want store credit for your store. Just give me my money back, and if you don't do exactly what I tell you, I'm going to do some sort of freak out, legitimate enough that the restaurant would have to install cameras afterwards." Must have been a bad bowl. Must have had, like, a baby's toe in it. Something, like, legit offensive. But yeah, did somebody, like, attack somebody, the person behind the counter? It's no matter what food you're getting, it's a $4 bowl of food. Is it worth losing your shit over? I know the customer's always right, but nobody's right in that situation. And then today, I was at Popeye's Fried Chicken. Yes, the famous Popeye's. It is the one you're thinking of. And as I walked in there, there were a few customers, but all of them were staring at this one guy at the front who was yelling at the person behind the counter, like causing a serious scene. I couldn't tell about what. I couldn't tell exactly what his complaint was, but something had really, really pissed him off. And he was going, "Let me talk to your manager. Where's the owner? I want to talk to the owner now. I want to talk about this shit that's going on." And the guy was like, "Hey, the manager's not here. I want to give you the number." And he said, "Yeah, I called the number. I called the number you gave me, and it just gave me a machine. It was automated." "Right, well, just enter in our store number, and it'll connect you to the store that number represents." "No, I called that, and it told me the phone system was out of order." "Well, that's not my problem." "Bullshit, it's not your problem. Let me talk to the manager."
The manager's not here right now. Is the manager automated? Yes, we have an automated manager. And no bullshit, he said it like that. He said it in a way that made me think he didn't actually understand the guy's sarcastic comment. He just wanted to get rid of the guy, so he was like, we have an automated manager. Whatever, buddy. And it's true, it's not his problem. Probably. Maybe he did make a mistake. You know, sometimes the customer actually is right, and I was starting to think after that exchange, as ridiculous as it was to see a customer making a scene like that in public, maybe he really was wronged, and maybe he just wanted to talk to somebody and get some recognizance, his $5 back or whatever. And this guy was refusing to let him speak to an actual human being, saying, "My manager's not there, you called this number which directed you to a machine." Sometimes you do just want to talk to somebody in charge. And I think you have a right as somebody who participates in this economy to do that. Okay, in this part, I just wrote down some words. I wrote them down in my outline. And I told myself that I was just going to read each word, which, you know, I wrote more than 24 hours ago, so the idea is I won't totally remember this list. And just say my thoughts on that word. So, here it goes. Whales. Whales are the biggest animal. They're full of blubber. Do Eskimos eat blubber? Is that really true? Really? They eat fat? It's just fat, right? I mean, I guess a marshmallow is just lard. But they do something to it. Eating lard is not the same thing as eating a marshmallow. It's just, you're just putting fat in you. What is the closest food experience we have to just eating fat? Would it be like eating a stick of butter? Is that just eating fat? Because I've eaten one of those restaurant-sized pats of butters before, and those are pretty tasty. I mean, I wouldn't want to eat the whole thing at once. I had, like, half of it. It's pretty good, though. Baseball. Used to be America's pastime. What happened, man? It got replaced. Football. Everybody loves football. Why? Because people, like, jump on each other and fall on each other? Because people are getting injured constantly? That was my experience watching football recently. It seems like somebody's just getting really badly hurt, like, every 5 minutes. Who wants to fucking watch that? That's nuts. Basketball's faster paced, I guess. Baseball's about strategy. I mean, I guess not really, because it's not strategy to just try to hit the ball as hard as you can, or run the bases as fast as you can. But I don't know, there's important, like, stay on this base, or try to steal it, or try to bunt. Switch positions with this guy, bring the shortstop a little closer in. I guess those are all strategic moves. I don't know. I guess I think it's just still all about running and hitting. Nintendo! Yes. Okay. I am not usually but a Nintendo system owner. I had a GameCube, which in retrospect seems like it was the weakest of the Nintendo systems. Unless it's the Wii U. Wow, that's sad. Maybe they've hit their bottom recently. But before that, I did have an SNES. I've never been much of a gamer. I can't compete with the hardcore game guys in nostalgia. But, like everybody, I did play Super Mario. A ton of Super Mario. Super Mario World was my main jam. I was just fascinated by all the worlds and all the different creatures and possible power-ups and bonus levels. I guess it was an early version of the game logic of Civilization, as you're always trying to capture new accomplishments, new worlds, new things. USPS. Wow. It's exciting. Let's talk about mail. Really? Okay, so I heard they're closed on Saturdays now, but I recently got a letter on Saturday, so I don't think that's true everywhere. Unless that guy was just doing it out of the goodness of his heart, like a volunteer postman who just believes
I'm gonna do my job whether they pay me or not. I said the oath. Whether go through rain or sleet or snow, I will not stop my postal watch this night. The postman comes to every door on every night and delivers mail thus, no matter what weather may befall him or what his paycheck may be. That is the postman's oath. Hallelujah. Not everybody knows that oath. I know that because I was studying to be a postman once before I got into radio. Little known fact. The next word I wrote was lawyer. What was I thinking when I was writing this? There's a lot of people in my family are lawyers. The stereotypical Jewish jobs are doctor and lawyer, always. Well, that's not really true. I think entertainment is also a stereotypical Jewish job. There's so many Jews in entertainment. I just went through for the one that's that doesn't have the guaranteed paycheck at the end of the tunnel. I don't know if that's true for lawyers anymore. I heard that there's been so many people trying to become lawyers that many of them can't find work anymore. That was more true during the recession, though. Not all the jobs have come back this recession, but the white-collar ones definitely have. Guys at the top, man. It's like it's LIFO. It's last in, first out. You're the last to lose your jobs. You're the first to get your jobs back. Privileges of being at the top. Jenga. Wait, I said that wrong. I said Jenga when I meant to say Jenga. Jenga. Really? These are the worst prompts. I hate my earlier self. I think I'm winning this podcast right now. Hi, Josh is beating Sober Josh. It's my current thinking. I may change my mind later. In parentheses next to Jenga, I wrote Jenga Unchained. Okay, that's pretty good. Quentin Tarantino's Jenga Unchained. In a world where children's board games are slaves, where adults force Monopoly and Scrabble and Sorry to dig ditches and plantations or whatever, one brave board game will stand up to Leonardo DiCaprio and the forces of evil with the help of Christoph Waltz. Jenga Unchained. Trust me, you don't want to topple him. That's the tagline. Although, if you were Jenga and you were fighting somebody, I think they would topple you. That's how they'd kill you. They wouldn't bother pulling pieces of you out one by one. Of course, they would just push you over. I mean, you're just a bunch of little wooden pieces that aren't, like, glued together or anything. You're really fragile. You're the worst hero ever. No one should make a movie about you. That means I should move on to my last keyword. This is better. Ninja. I think I can work with a ninja. I don't know. Ninja's already been mined for a lot of material. Them and zombies. Vampires. People have gotten way too into zombies and vampires. They've tried to launch werewolves, but I don't think werewolves are getting into that territory. Mummies? No, it doesn't seem right to have mummies. You always want to have a singular mummy. A wave of mummies doesn't seem that scary. Though it might, I guess it might be. Is there any other horror movie archetype we can make cool? Ghosts? There's something cool about ghosts, I guess, but they can't interact with people. Most of the time. It depends what ghost you are. Some ghosts can pick things up and, you know, be like poltergeists. But when you're a Patrick Swayze ghost, you can only interact with people if you're helping them make pottery. Ding! Now, seriously, there's got to be... There's nothing that's competing with zombies and vampires. Are we just doomed to have zombie and vampire movies forever? Somebody's got to make something new. Maybe evil ninjas. Bring it full circle. We can segue by having a movie about zombie ninjas first. People will respond because they're zombies. And people mindlessly love zombies. It's like they're zombies for zombies. But zombie ninjas, you know, maybe there was like a band of ninjas who was killed in 400 AD. And now they're rising to fight for their undead master. They still have retained all their ninja skills. This is, I think, a much more promising movie than Jenga Unchained. And then we can just have movies about evil ninjas. I think there's room to work with there. I forgot about one of the other things I did this weekend, besides play Epic Games of Civilization, is I did a little bit of networking. That's right. I live in Hollywood, and I network. I make connections. I make connects. It was a New Year's Day party that a friend of my dad's throws every year. My dad does know some of these, like, Hollywood guys. This was a producer on a fairly big TV series, I'm not going to say which one, holding a party. And he invited me to come with him, partly to just spend New Year's Day together, but partly to, yeah, make connect with this guy and maybe impress him and let him know I'm an aspiring writer, et cetera, et cetera. Seems like a long shot, of course, but you never know. And they've got an amazing house in Encino, and I walk in, and there's all these people that just, you know, they just look like people. They just look like they're having a good time. Some of them might have high-ranking jobs in the entertainment industry. Some of them don't. I don't really know. But after making small talk with a few of them for a while over how nice their house was, I eventually got directed to the guy himself, who seemed like he was seated at a table outside, and almost like the godfather accepting requests on the day of his daughter's wedding, was just kind of having discourse after discourse with a line of people who kept walking up to him. And my dad and I are standing around awkwardly for a while, and then eventually my dad finds a moment and says, "Hey, wonderful to be back. I love your annual party," and, you know, pleasantries, small talk. Eventually, "Hey, this is my son Josh," and how do you react in that situation? What is the good option in my situation talking to some big producer guy who I happen to meet randomly? Because you almost feel like you have to mention you're an aspiring writer at some point. Otherwise, why did you even go to this party? Just to kind of hang out with this guy who has no reason to remember you? But look, the moment he asks, "So, what do you do?" And I say, "Hey, you know, I'm an aspiring writer. I've written a few spec scripts." You know his guard is going to go up like that. He's instantly going to be suspicious. He's probably heard this spiel a billion times from people. You've got a couple minutes. How do you make an impression on this guy and let him know you're looking for work without seeming like some overambitious prick? Of course, maybe that's not what networking is about. Maybe the point of networking is to actually make friends with people. That's so much work, though. Work that he could be spending doing the actual creative things I want to sell. Anyway, what could I do but just be like, "Hey, how's it going, producer guy? Lovely house you have. I really love that show you do. I tried to make a couple of interesting insights about the show that probably just sounded like some armchair critic." And eventually he asks, you know, "So what do you do?" And I say, "Well, hey, I'm trying to be a writer myself." And you do see his face change a little bit, his guard goes up. But he does say, "Hey, so what do you write?" A little this, little that. I explain a couple of the different projects I'm working on. He says, "Okay, sounds great." We make a little more small talk, and then he notices somebody else from across the room and says, "Hey," and we leave. An interesting sort of meeting that I haven't done a lot, but I'm sure happens hundreds of times a day in Los Angeles. Trying to talk to somebody who could, in some possible future world, be your boss, and trying to sound smooth, but impressive, talented, but not overambitious, memorable, but not pestering. And I think I would give my performance a B. It was not awful, but I think I could do better. It just goes to show I need more practice with this stuff. I'm not a natural at this. I feel totally insincere doing it. But I know that meeting people is, like, the key to actually, you know, getting these kind of jobs. So I'm going for it. I'm going to keep going to every party I can, saying, why not? Maybe one of these days I actually will make a joke that strikes somebody the right way, and they'll say, hey, let me read one of your scripts. And sometimes that's the key. Oh, I got another Twitter question from @KevinDoherty40. Have you ever walked in on your parents having sex? And if so, describe in great slow detail what you saw. I can say I'm one of, maybe this is a common occurrence. I can say I'm one of the lucky few who have never walked in on their parents having sex. You know what was awkward, though, was walking in on your parents having sex. It's true. I caught him in flagrante delicto. Got so much hair on both of them. Your mother is a hairy, hairy woman. And in places like nobody has hair. Like in the cracks of her fingers, in her belly button. Even like her vagina looked hairy. Not like the outside either, like inside her vagina. There was hair. I got a very close look in that split second. It's burned in my memory. But they covered up quickly and then ran out of my house. Your parents were also fucking in my house. God, that and that circle jerk? What's wrong with your parents? One more thing I did this week was I saw another movie. I mentioned a couple weeks ago that Inside Llewyn Davis is my favorite movie of 2013 so far, but that was before I saw the movie Her. It's either my number one or number two. I'm still not sure. It's a toss-up. And it's possible it was because it was another movie I way over-identified with. I mean, holy shit. First of all, it's another movie about where the main character is somebody who recently lost their partner. In this case, he was the main character, Theodore, was getting a divorce. This character who's, I guess he's a bit of an indie movie cliche, but he also did remind me of me, a guy who's, you know, good-natured and talented, but shy and sensitive and prone to getting his emotions hurt easily. But that wasn't even the eerie part. The eerie part would be the constant parallels to my last relationship. I'm still friends with Carla, and she called me after she saw the movie herself, and she called me after the movie to say, I am Samantha. And I said, yeah. Now, this is something I'm going to talk about this a little bit, I guess, but I don't want to get into like a ton of detail. I would just put it like this. That going out with a married woman is a little bit like going out with an OS. You can have very real feelings for each other. You know, I did have feelings for her. She did have feelings for me. But there's kind of a doomed quality to it. You know that you're in a relationship that eventually has to end. Because it's never going to be exactly what we're looking for. So there's no real possibility of commitment. And yet, maybe even because of that, it can create a safe space where, you know, connection and personal growth can happen. Because, I don't know, because you feel like you can be honest and you can be yourselves with each other. Some mild spoilers for the movie. It is about this guy who I feel is kind of like me, who's dating the new conscious operating system on his phone. And first of all, it's really nice to see a movie where the prospect of artificial intelligence isn't greeted completely skeptically. Like everyone in the movie just kind of quickly accepts that this artificially conscious operating system that doesn't even have any sort of body is a real mind, is essentially on the same level as a human being and not treated as some other. And that's amazing. But so this guy gets a phone that has a consciousness on it called Samantha that's supposed to act kind of like his personal helper who helps check his email and do his work, etc. It's like 80 years in the future. It's like Siri times a million. But there's a scene midway through the movie where he's talking to his ex-wife and he tells her he is dating his operating system, Samantha. And she accuses him of dating her because he was afraid of dealing with real emotions. And that stung a little bit, watching that. Though I don't even know if that's a fair critique. What if you do believe, as I believe, that artificial intelligence could be completely conscious, a person in the same way a human is a person, then why aren't their emotions any less real? And it's true that the relationship I was in kind of dodged real commitment, but that didn't mean there were not real emotions involved. And then there's another scene later in the movie where Samantha has to explain to Theo how she might be able, how she might love other people, but that doesn't dim the love she has for him at all. That it's possible to love someone else and still love the original person just as much. And Theo is saying back, that's not how love works for him. And that conversation, like, happened verbatim in my life. It was a tough movie to watch at times for those reasons, but like the best movies, it gave me a little insight into my own life. You know, Samantha and Theodore don't get their happy ending at the very end of the movie, but she was good for him. He was going through a tough period, and she brought him out of his shell. She encouraged him to make friends with the people around him. She convinced him to publish his work. By the time she's left, I think it's clear that the protagonist has gone through like a major positive change in his life. All because of a real love that they shared. Even if it was with an AI program that was programmed to respond perfectly to your needs, and therefore didn't exactly have the autonomy of a real woman. Didn't make her feelings any less real. And it is those kind of uncomfortable thoughts that's part of the reason I think this is a great movie. You know, he helped her too. He opened her up too. He helped her accept who she was. She didn't understand what it meant to, you know, she desperately wanted a body, and she later learned to accept herself and who she was. And it helped her eventually get to like a new level of consciousness. And in general, it's cool to see a vision of the future that isn't like a dystopia. You know, compare this to Elysium, which, you know, had the perfect, which had a planet full of slums, but this perfect world floating in space. But even the perfect world seemed hellish. It was just this boring world full of boring people. This movie is a movie full of real people, and both human and not, that are connecting with each other. You know, people who haven't become cold and hardened by technology. It's almost like a world where humans are fumbling and outclassed and stumbling to keep up with technology that's rapidly outpacing them. But they're still warm and loving and recognizably human. At one point in the movie, one of the characters says love is a socially acceptable form of insanity. And I'm stealing that line because it's completely apt. The whole point of love is that you're kind of going outside of your comfort zone. You're doing something a little crazy. That's what romance is. I love the visual style of the movie. I love the constant close-up shots of Joaquin Phoenix's face. I love the completely human point of view. It's such an earnest movie. Maybe earnestness is the new irony. I think by making this a completely straight-faced love story, Spike Jonze has made his boldest movie so far. Possibly even beating Being John Malkovich, which is one of my favorite movies of all time. So that's saying a lot. All the personal stuff aside, it is just a great movie. And I think a lot of people are identifying with it in interesting ways. So I highly recommend you see it. I'm running out of time. I think I've got to wrap this up. This was an interesting experiment. Before I go, I just want to say thank you. A serious thank you to all you guys who have, we're four episodes in, we're a month into this podcast. Thank you for listening. All you guys who went and bought the 5-second rule, thank you for checking it out. Thanks for just being part of this first wave and supporting me. I can't wait to keep doing more stuff in the future. Next week, my dad might be on. Maybe. I'm going to see if I can put that together in time. That might be possible. Otherwise, you may get more randomness. We'll see. But I may be featuring the first ever guest on Josh Figures It Out very soon. Until next time. So long. Farewell. Auf Wiedersehen. Goodbye. I said that so rhythmically. I'm proud of myself. It's been real. I asked myself a question this morning. When I'm doing these podcasts, am I talking to myself or am I talking to you? Because if there wasn't a you on the other end, I wouldn't be talking to anybody. It's like the podcast wouldn't exist. If a tree falls in the forest and no one hears it, doesn't make a sound. But it also just feels like I'm sitting in a room by myself talking to myself. This is so ridiculous. I can't believe anyone would listen to this. But I'm glad you guys are. Anyhow, till next time, peace and love. Catch you guys on the flip side. Ciao.